buzzing reference will become clear shortly. To have had this chat with the wonderful beekeeper, there we go, mead maker and former lawyer Michael Walsh. In this conversation, we chat initial reasons for getting into law and some of the challenges faced with that industry. We touch on some of the top level thinking behind the transition from lawyer to beekeeper. We chat moving to China and the difficulties, and to be honest, the loneliness of initially not knowing or really being able to communicate with anyone. And some general mead making and social media influencing chit chat. So let's get down to business. Sorry. And crack on. Michael Walsh, aka Mikey Boy, aka the most charming man in the world.
You're too kind.
How are we doing?
Yeah, very good. Very good, Howie.
Shall we start with introductions? As much for my sake as anyone listening, because this is technically just the second time we've met each other.
That's true. Yeah, the first time was a longer, our friendship, as a result of that. It was over a weekend in Glasgow.
For Pierre's stag do. So, don't remember too much of that. So, a little reminder of the introduction might be good. Do you want to go name, where you're from, and what is the best decade for music?
My name is Michael Walsh. I am from Greenwich in southeast London. Best decade for music, that is a tricky one. I think a lot of people just say they're their formative decade, really, for when they grew up, their teenage years. But I'm going to go a bit before that.
You strike me as an alternative.
Yeah, I like stuff from like the 80s. It's quite fun. There were a lot of good tracks then, but I'm quite open to different types of music, really. I haven't really got a specific genre or a specific decade. I mean, music's changed so much in the last 100 years and even in the last 50 years, really.
So you're not going to go like the 1700s?
No, the classical. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, there are times, I think, times and places for that. Like, it's great for, like, if you've got the task to do or something, like, classical music's fantastic, and or if you appreciate and you go to a concert, classical music's great. But I have a diverse taste, I think, in music. It just depends on how I'm feeling, really.
Top band from the 80s? I'm holding you to the 80s.
Oh, okay. I'd say the Clash. Yeah, yeah. The 70s, 80s. Had some good tunes.
And we were down by the river, rather aptly.
We were.
They sang that, didn't they? The Clash, London's Calling.
London's Calling, yeah.
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 Down by the river, that's them. This morning, after you dropped off your bees in Canary
Wharf. I did, yeah. Today was a bee delivery day. By way of background, I'm a beekeeper.
I love this, by the way. This is so good. As soon as she said that to me, I'm like, right, he's on the podcast.
On the podcast.
I got my booking team in touch with yours, and we sorted it. We
made it happen. So I got into beekeeping, background story, when I was 10. Went down to my local beekeeping club. Was just keen to find out about the world and find out about these important insects and the role they play in the world we live in. And ever since then, I've had an interest in bees. I had a massive hiatus, actually, and got back into it properly about 6 or 7 years ago now. Started keeping my own bees, went down to the club more, did some courses, and then managed to persuade my first company I was working for at the time to get bees. When I started working, I was working as a lawyer, and I was keeping bees alongside that, and then pivoted into beekeeping as a career in the last couple of years, trying to do that full time, and working with corporates as part of their ESG strategy, helping to help a species in need and increase biodiversity in the area. By essentially if it's the right area, inserting beehives on rooftops, essentially, and then managing them, working with the company to increase awareness of honeybees, and not just honeybees, other pollinators as well.
Well, this is a big platform, just, the reach for this.
Oh, yeah, I mean, hopefully it persuades a lot of people to potentially plant more flowers, and wildflowers are very important now as well, of course, to help honeybees, but not just honeybees, all pollinators out there, because they're so important for ourselves.
Your knowledge of flowers was something I didn't know until our walk this morning.
It's quite complementary to beekeeping.
Yeah.
I've just always loved being outdoors, really. And I think that was one of the reasons, actually, that got me into this move from law into beekeeping. It was during the pandemic. Everyone was working from home. I didn't really have that same connection to nature, which I'm nurturing now and developing more now. I found I really missed that I had when I was younger, and I wanted to do more of that. And that really encouraged me to make that transition from law into something which would allow me to spend more time outdoors and spend more time in nature, which really gives me that calm and that peace. And I love it when I'm around plants and flowers, and especially nice smelling flowers. It brings me a real calm and allows me to really be in the moment. I mean, when you're in beekeeping, you'll have to come down to the apiary. You really are in the moment when you're doing it. You are with the insects. You are with them, and there's nothing else that comes into your head. It's fantastic. It's a real privilege to be there with them, you attend to them, really, as their humble servant.
I can imagine that is quite meditative, as you say. Almost by definition, you can't be thinking of anything else. It requires like your complete and utter focus, right? So you can get into that almost that flow state, which is just very calming.
Mm, yeah, and I think that's why it's so popular. And with certain groups of people, especially towards later life, a lot of people get into beekeeping. And once they get into it, that they tend to stick to it because it has that. If they've got the time, it tends to have that real calming effect. And if people report, like, if they've got problems in their lives or there's been a bereavement or anything like that, a lot of people just go and speak to their bees, or there is an old tradition, I think, I think it even happened when the queen passed away, of the beekeeper telling the bees that the queen had passed away. Or there's that tradition in Anglo-Saxon or Celtic or old tradition, even in Ireland as well. This tradition of telling the bees when there's been a bereavement in the family, and that goes way back. And I think there's that thing of including the bees and being with the bees. I mean, not literally talking to them all the time, but I mean, you know, being with them and having that peacefulness when you're with them. Which I think
do they? This might be a ridiculous question, show my ignorance, but do they almost recognise you? Is there some sort of emotional connection there, like with dogs and other sorts of animals?
Studies into this, actually, recently. I think it's still quite early days in terms of recognition and how much we can tell in terms of who they're going to remember. Whether they remember the apiarist, as in the beekeeper, or other people. But I think there is, in terms of that scientific development, there's a lot going on at the moment in terms of bees' memory and on what they feel. Are they sentient beings? And the scientific research is starting to look like they are. They have these senses, these emotions, and I mean, it's quite bizarre though, because at the same time, when you think about beekeeping, beekeepers and everyone else involved in beekeeping thinks about the hive as one organism rather than individuals. So then when you start breaking it down to the individuals having these all certain different emotions, it becomes a change then. Is it that's set by the hive or the queen of pheromones, or are these individual bees? Because then it kind of changes the whole conception of them being one organism as opposed to individuals. And then it makes it a bit, as a beekeeper as well, I think it kind of changes the way you beekeep in that way, if you start thinking of them like that. So, but it is early days, and there's scientific research being done on this. I think there's a lab in Queen Mary's who are working on this I read recently in the Beecraft, the Beekeepers magazine, that they were looking into that. Yeah.
Where's my coffee? Yeah. I was hoping you were going to bring me one.
I should bring you one next time. Yeah.
So you transitioned from law to beekeeping, which we can get into a bit more detail on. What made you initially want to get into law? And I suppose the context behind that question is there's always a whole host of different reasons why we do anything in life, right? So ranging from intrinsic, i.e. doing something for the pure love, enjoyment, fulfillment of doing it, to extrinsic, i.e. looking for some sort of external reward, recognition, whether that's financial, status, reputation, approval of parents, etc., etc., etc. And there's no obvious like right or wrong reason to do it, and there's probably some sort of optimal blend between the two that's probably different for each individual based on their values and ambitions, etc. So I suppose the context behind the question is that law, and I suppose I'd probably put, you know, maybe other professions like architecture and medicine, being a doctor, finance in this category as well, is that there are a lot of extrinsic rewards of doing that, and therefore it can be quite an extrinsically tempting career to get into. Tends to pay pretty well. If you meet someone for the first time and they're like, oh, so what is it you do, which is a common question, if you say you're like, I'm a lawyer or an architect or a doctor, you almost, it's quite impressive, right? So you almost get a degree of respect and acceptance from that. So not to lead your response in a certain way, but what were the initial reasons you got into law? How did that evolve and change over time? And then I suppose, how do you reflect on that now?
I suppose I first got into law, I did some work experience in my undergraduate degree, and I enjoyed that. It was an IP attorney, and I enjoyed the process of shadowing him at...
Because did you go to uni study law? Or?
No, so my first degree at university was in war studies, which is kind of like international relations, government politics,
yeah,
military history, strategy, all encompassed in one degree. And I enjoyed that. And I was quite fortunate to have a year abroad as part of that in my second year. It was a 3-year course, but I could spend the second year out abroad. So I went to America for that year abroad, which was fantastic. And when I was over there, I was exposed to a lot of like legislators, policy makers who would come and talk at the university. They'd give talks. So at the time, it was just after Gordon Brown was PM here, actually gave a talk at, in the American University, bizarrely. Oh, wow. But he was in the area, he was in Washington, D.C., so he was in the area, and then he came and gave a talk, and so did William Hague. Barack Obama came to campus, and they all gave a speech.
Some good name-dropping.
And it was quite inspiring,
here.
Yeah. I mean, even Prince Charles, and now King Charles came and gave a talk. So it was quite a lot of exposure to these like legislators, and it was interesting. A lot of them had backgrounds in law, and it seemed quite interesting. So that kind of inspired that initial interest in law as a potential career. And
was that, sorry to interrupt, was that more out of an interest, i.e. something you'd enjoy, or did you almost look at people of that status and you're like, oh, that's, you know, that's a bit of me.
Wouldn't mind a bit of that.
Yeah.
I think because I'd actually had the, not really hands-on, but the shadowing experience, that kind of gave me a flavour of perhaps what it would entail.
Yeah.
And I didn't have lots of work experiences, so from what I had, I enjoyed that the most at the time, and the work experiences I had. So I thought, you know what, it was good. You know, I might as well try and go down that avenue. And those characters I mentioned, I mean Barack Obama, very charismatic when he's talking. And,
yeah, he's coming on the pod next
week.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to listening to that. Actually, yeah. Tell him I said hi. Yeah. So I mean, yeah, I think those kind of people were quite inspirational. I think when you see them talk, and it's interesting that they came from a background in law. But I think for me, predominantly, it was that work experience that gave me a flavour of what it might be like day to day. And therefore, I thought, you know, I might try and pursue this later on down the line. And then eventually, after my degree, in more studies. I did the 2-year senior status law degree, which is essentially a 3-year degree in 2 years if you've got a degree already.
Yeah.
Similar to, if you listeners are aware, of the GDL, which is the usual law conversion that most people do, is 1 year. This is 2 years, and you do.
They're probably not. They're not the brightest. More
subjects and indoor debt.
Georgia.
Very educated listeners, I'm sure. Yeah. And then eventually went down the legal route that way.
How did you find it? Because you were working for, do we want to name drop here?
You can, or, if you want. Yeah. You
were working for Clifford Chance.
Yep.
Biggest, most famous law firm in London, is it? It's up there. It's one of the prestigious ones.
It's a magic circle law firm. It was good. It felt like a community, really. And that was one thing I valued about the firm, is that when you come through, you have a cohort. So every 6 months there are new people coming through on the undergraduate scheme or the trainee solicitors, and you get to know these people beforehand because you do something called the LPC, which is a legal practice course. It's kind of a university experience in London. You do it at a law school, if you like, that's geared towards either the LPC if you're going down the solicitor route, or the BPTC if you're going down the bar route, the barrister route. And it's great because you're in class with your future colleagues, you get to know them in the social side as well, rather than just in a work side. So even when you're starting at the firm, you know so many people going into that, so you've got a community already. And in the way it's geared up, you've got so much going on in the building itself that lends itself to, when you do have the time, to spend time with the people you got to know on the LPC, or even meeting new people, your colleagues, other people on the training contract. I mean, you just have so many amenities there. I'm very privileged to have that there. I mean, like, you have a swimming pool, a gym, a squash court, there's like a canteen, you've even got laundrette, dry cleaners there. I mean, some people, they're hairdressers, some people go there for that, a bar. It was all happening in one building, so it was quite, it was like a very much a community aspect there, because you had everything you needed.
And not to sound really cynical about that. So that's great, obviously that's amazing. However, there is an incentive of the company to keep you there, right? Because the more time you spend there, the more bought in you are to their culture, the more work you're probably going to do, the more invested you feel, the more committed you're going to be.
I think Google-esque in a way. I mean, yes. I heard Google do have a similar kind of setup in their campus, you know. And I think it is effective in creating that community, creating that sense of belonging and also wanting to be there.
Yeah.
It makes it easy. I mean, I'm not going to exaggerate. Corporate law, there can be long hours. Do you know? Mm. I mean, it's not necessarily a 9-to-5.
How would you define long hours? What would an average week look like, do you reckon? Or does it vary so much?
Qualify. I think it depends on the department you're in. It really does. So I qualify it by saying it depends on which departments you're in.
Yeah.
Different departments have different hours, and there are some departments which are quiet for a long time, and then it's just all hands to deck, and it's morning, like finishing in the morning, early hours of the morning job kind of thing. So it really does vary. I would say they were much. They're much more than a 9-to-5 on average, you know. But I mean, there were people I know in departments that are getting out at 6 or 7 kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it really does vary. But it would be more than your standard job for those.
What was it like for you? And did you enjoy that, and almost a sense of community, and it's exciting and you're all in it together? Or did you have a bit of a negative relationship with it, and almost a slight resent that you had to almost commit your life to it? Or did it evolve over time? Like, what was your relationship with those requirements, basically?
I think it was quite easy to get into the flow of things, in a sense that my life was quite predictable. I mean, I would get up, I'd go to work early, I'd try and go to the gym early if I could, before work. Go to work, and then I might get lunch with friends, which would be quite social. They have a canteen there. You can meet people you knew from the LPC or other friends, and then you would work, and often if you were staying late, you'd get dinner as well, and you might even see some friends down there as well. So that kind of lifestyle, it was quite easy to get into the flow of it, and you didn't really think about the future or tomorrow. You were in a weird way in the moment, because it was you were just doing those things, but they were there for you, so you didn't have to. I mean, so traveling around London, such a big city, and like traveling around it, like if you've got your gym here and you've got your friends, you're meeting them in another restaurant there, it's that traveling time, which is quite draining in itself. And if you've got everything in one unit, if you like, it does make it a bit easier. Your choice, I think the thing is that when you work those long hours and you have everything in a building, that choice element, it is to a certain extent taken away, because it is all there, and it's that convenience. I mean, obviously everyone still has a choice, but the convenience means that you're more likely to pick that choice of staying in the building and going to the gym there, or seeing your friends in the work. If you've got work to finish off in the evening, you're going to just go and finish it off your desk rather than going out and then coming back. So it's that convenience which makes it more doable, if you like, the whole thing.
How long were you there for?
3.5 years in total.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then was it after that that you transitioned to beekeeping, or was there an interim place that you worked at?
Mm-hmm. So I went to a US firm after that for another probably about year and a half. And that was during COVID.
Did you start during COVID?
I started during COVID.
That's tough, isn't it?
It is. It was very tough. And again, because you're in a new place, you don't have all of I suppose people from the LPC or your you've come through the training contract with, which is 2 years. So you don't have that community already established. So it's a bit more challenging in that regard to try and recreate that social environment and that community. And especially when you're at home as well, that's an added challenge. And all, I suppose, the perks of being in a role like that are gone, because you don't have your gym on site now. You don't have your canteen on site. Everything isn't there for you to make your life that much easier. And I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're doing long hours, I mean, like midnight finishes or early in the morning finishes, 4 or 5 a.m.s, it does make it a bit easier when everything is there, just for 100%. You to just pop down and quickly get some food and then come back up and back at your desk.
Well, that's the upsides of the role, right? Such a demanding role, but at least you're surrounded by people that you know, that you studied with. There is the gym, places to eat. So that's the kind of upside. But working from home, you kind of have all the downside with little of the upside, or less of the upside, I should say.
Yeah, I think a lot of you're right. A lot of the upsides are stripped away. And I think a lot of people struggle with it across the industry, especially those long hours. Because before, at least you were in an environment, a different environment to your home. But now you were doing these long hours and you were in your home. And I think for a lot of the junior people, struggle with it more, because by the nature of the world we live in, those who are more junior have smaller spaces. We live in apartments, flats, or so you don't have the luxury of having potentially a designated space where you can just say, right, that's for work. Everything blends into one, and you have this blend between work and life outside of work. And I think that is challenging. It was challenging during COVID. And I think a lot of people found that very challenging. The fact that everything was kind of one, and especially when you're doing long hours as well. So I think for me, I started to think a bit, like, I would love to have more of that time outside as well.
Because were you doing the beekeeping on the side at this point?
I've been doing beekeeping for the last 6-7 years,
so that's been a constant
my own apiary. I've been tending to them, I had them at the firm as well when I was at Clifford Chance.
So you actually kept them on site
Oh, wow.
Amazing.
So I've had
So you're the busiest bee in more ways than one.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it a lot.
Awesome. And then, so what was the, I suppose, what was the main catalyst to drive you to go full time, to kind of pack in the law? Was it that lockdown and essentially wanting to get outside a bit more? Was that the main driver?
Yeah, I think so. I think for me, it was that desire to be, to do more in nature. As I was saying before, like, I feel very relaxed out there. I feel very calm in nature. It's difficult to put into words. It's that sense of just being very much in the moment. As you said before, that flow state, it's very relaxing. And I do enjoy that. Not that I don't not enjoy law. I do also enjoy the process of being a lawyer. But I wanted that balance, and I found during COVID I wasn't getting that balance. It was nice to try and restore that by then going off and trying something a bit different.
Nice. So, like, all in, life-wise, do you feel like that's a more fulfilling lifestyle for you now that you're doing that? Like, what's your, I suppose, your headspace at now? Is it notably different, notably better?
I think it's still quite challenging in the sense that it's different. I mean, being a beekeeper is very different to being a lawyer, financially to begin with. And I think it's, again, I think more comes down to the difference between being employed and having your own business. I think it's very challenging to have that same kind of motivation when you've got your own business, unless you're really, really passionate about it, as when you are in a corporate environment and you've got tasks that are there and quite clear. And sometimes it can be quite challenging to know what the next thing to do is when you have your own business, especially when you're a one-man show. Like, it's different, I suppose, when you set up it, you have a number of people setting it up together, or you're pivoting in a similar industry to what you did before, so you kind of know the things to tick off to get ahead and to grow that company. So I think there are definitely challenges, but they're different challenges. So it's not all plain sailing. I've left the corporate world. I think there are different hurdles. It's a different kind of thing, really.
What are some of the main challenges and pain points that you want to share?
Yeah, and I think getting yourself out there, getting more clients. I think establishing beehives on the roof of an office space is quite a challenge, and internally for the company to get the sign off, to jump through a number of hoops. When I first got them at my the first law company at Clifford Chance, it took about a year to get the process to get the sign off, and it's time, and there are a number of steps you need to go through. So I think acquiring new clients, it's a challenge. That's just one that I'm thinking about, new ways of trying to get out there, really. And also, I mean, there are beehives. That's not a completely novel approach. I mean, there are other people in the industry as well. And it's not like in the corporate world where, let's say you're a bank and you need some legal work done, you might use X law firm. But then the next month you might have another deal and use Y law firm. You know, you're quite interchangeable. But when it comes to a beekeeper, it's quite unheard of for a company to get rid of their beekeeper and say, right, I don't want him anymore. I'll have him or her. I think that in itself means that the turnover is less so with getting clients. So it's a challenging thing. So I think that is probably the main hurdle, obviously, for a business is getting clients. I suppose secondly, it's being a one man, like having your own company, you know, and I'm grateful that my partner does help me. But in essence, day to day, trying to do this yourself. I think any business starting it for yourself, it's a challenge because you don't have that structure that you would have if you're in a job, in like a corporate job. And I think that is a challenge in itself as well, like knowing what to do next.
Yeah, of course.
Would I do this? And if I did this, would I be able to do this? And it's evaluating all the pros and cons of doing things, and if you've missed opportunities, if you do one thing and not do the other thing.
Yeah.
I think it is a challenge, really. And it's just learning, really. It's like, in a way, it's kind of learning on the job, you know, going back to school, but in a different way, you're actually learning for a business now to try and grow it. And then thinking about other ventures that are complementary to that as well, to see if potentially that's an avenue one might like to explore or it might be interesting.
And then, excuse the ignorance of this question, but in terms of how it works, so if you got like, what's the collective noun for bees? A hive of bees, obviously, isn't it? Have you got a hive of bees like at your place where you live? And if you get like a new client, do you then take like a portion of that hive and drop them off at said client? Like, is that how it works?
Yeah, essentially, you would have your own apiary where you would keep your hives, X number of hives. Then, if you were depending on how you were beekeeper, you would breed bees or breed queens, and then have a section of your apiary that you would then sell to clients, or if they wanted to.
And then, do you look after those?
It depends on what the requirement is from the potentially interested party, whether they just want bees. And there are some companies out there who just want bees. If they've got their own beekeeper, or they want to do it in-house, or they might just want bees. So I could supply them with bees. Or there's the other scenario where someone wants a hive set up and they want me to manage it as well.
Right, I see.
I would then set that up, get the hives, and then bring the bees and introduce them. If to begin with, if it's appropriate, once I've done the assessment off the area, to install the hives, if it's appropriate, then I would go ahead with that.
Well, good that business is going well. talking of businesses, you also make your own mead.
Yeah.
That you fueled the boys with in Glasgow.
My trial batch, yeah.
How's that going?
It's good. It's still quite initial days. And as I said before, like when I was talking about the business and thinking about things that are quite complementary, mead was something which is complementary to beekeeping, because mead is made from honey, water and yeast. And it is one of the oldest alcoholic drinks out there. I mean, potentially prehistoric people would come across a flooded hive, a bee's nest, that'd be water, obviously, and mixed with honey and then wild yeast, and it would be fermented, and it would have one, the benefit of being safe to drink, because the fermentation of the yeast would have got rid of potentially or any bad bacteria or anything in there. And it would be alcoholic, so they'd potentially have quite a good time by drinking this. and before we had beer, that was the go-to alcoholic drink in our society. It used to be brewed a lot by the monks. But as hops introduced and people started making the move to beer, mead was largely forgotten about. And it's something which has had a bit of a resurgence in relatively recent times, but it is an industry which potentially, hopefully, will grow in the future, and it's something which I'm looking into. It's still quite early days. I'm playing around with a number of recipes to find one that I like, and then hopefully go from there.
Bring us back to our ancestral roots.
Exactly. Yeah.
I was hoping you're going to bring a bottle with you today, but
Of course, no, I haven't actually got one, but next time, yeah, that could have made it quite interesting, actually.
You're a big traveller. You have done a lot of travelling and you've lived in quite a few different countries. Am I right in thinking, talk to me about China. You lived there a couple of years?
I was in China for a year, yeah. After my first degree in war studies, I spent a year out there on a Chinese government scholarship learning Mandarin, and it was a good year, really good year. It was essentially university, 5 days a week, learning Mandarin written, spoken, And yeah, I think when I first got there, it was quite challenging, I think. I was just finished my degree, 21 years old. I had done that year abroad in Washington, D.C. before. And it's much easier when you go to a country which is native English speakers there, and going somewhere where that wasn't the case. I think it was an overall challenge.
Did you know anyone that you went, that was there?
No, or
did you
just no I just went by myself. And initially it was very challenging. I think having a lack of language and someone who's been used to talking to people and enjoy having that social interaction and chit-chat with people, I just didn't have that anymore. And it took some time before my language was up to a level before you could have that engagement. And the thing is, you're thrown into an environment like this and not everyone is native English speakers. So a lot of people don't speak English. So you're learning with, which I mean, it's very hard for them. They would often get English as a result of that because English was the instruction. There were translations you'd have, like translations, but it'd be English. So full credit to the people who came not being able to speak English, and there were a lot of them. I think it might be the first semester, it's the majority actually, that were that had that struggle. And I think that was quite challenging because when you're speaking with non-native English speakers and people that can't really speak, you have to use Mandarin, really, which is good for the language learning. I think it was very good for that. But I think challenging on the social side, but very good to try and pick up the language and then learn together. And then it gives you the chance to then more engage with outside of your classroom, the community, when you're in the shops and when you're on the street, when you're in the marketplace. And I think that inspired me more, I think, to want to learn it because to that need to communicate. I think as humans, we have that desire to communicate and be understood. Yeah. And I think that desire drove me to try and learn the spoken element as much as I could. My spoken is much better than my written. I think, again, it comes down to wanting to have that engagement, wanting to go to the shop, just speak to people who've had questions about where an item was. I could be, where is this? Or when I'm travelling out and about, getting taxis, travelling, asking people, engaging with people, and just having that little chit-chat, which is just so important, I think, just having that basic communication. And that took time to get to that, and that's why it was challenging to begin with.
That's a really interesting point, because, as you say, for learning the language, completely immersing yourself in it is amazing and really accelerates that aspect of it and kind of picking up the written and the verbal communication. However, for making social connections, friendships, which is so important when you move somewhere new and you don't know anyone, that kind of suffers a little bit, doesn't it? Because if you're restricted by the amount that you can communicate with someone, you can only really get so close to someone. So did you find it almost quite lonely when you moved over, or were you more excited about the novelty and the learning the language that it didn't matter so much? Like, was it a difficult time?
Yeah, no, it was definitely a difficult time. I think myself, someone who likes being outgoing, likes talking to people, likes meeting new friends, I think that was definitely a struggle. And it took time to meet people. It really did, and get past that language barrier. It was definitely a real challenge. I mean, I was very eager to learn. That's why I was there. But I think definitely social element did have a big effect on me, as in I wanted to get better so I could communicate, but also I wanted to make those connections and meet people. And I mean, the second semester, I did eventually start meeting people. I was going out more. I was meeting new people, and I was in moved to the city campus. I was in the suburbs before, and that definitely helped. I think having that, being more in the central, there were more people. There were actually a lot more people there, and more chances of communicating and meeting people. And then there were a lot of Australians, funny enough, actually, because I was in Nanjing, and Nanjing has a relationship with the state of Victoria. So there's like a scholarship, and there were a lot of people from Victoria, Melbourne, who were there, and they were in the city, and I only met them in the second semester because they were only in the city. And it was quite nice to meet them and then develop a connection there. And I still keep in contact with them to this day, really, and still good friends with them. And I think it's just a time thing. So I think a combination of being in an environment, the longer you're in an environment, the more people you're exposed to, and your language skills get better as well. But I think with all these things, things often start off as hard when you first move to a new area.
Yeah.
But over time, you start to develop those relationships, whether that's through meeting people, like as in you haven't met them to begin with, or just developing the current relationships. And I think for me, first meeting people was a challenge because of the lack of English and my lack of Chinese, Mandarin. And then over time, my Mandarin got better, and then I started being exposed to more people as well. So I kind of managed to cover both fronts eventually, if you know what I mean. But so I met people from my Australia and English speaking world and had a similar culture there. But then my Mandarin got better, so I could communicate with people who were perhaps weren't native English speakers as well. So then I kind of had the best of both eventually. But that was only came with
took time. Why did you move back?
To England.
Yeah.
Well, I had a place to read law, and I'd actually deferred that for a year anyway.
Okay.
So I had that as an option to come back to. So originally, actually, I was always thinking about law, but I wasn't sure whether I'd do it out there in China or whether I'd come back. Now, I actually had a full scholarship over there, because the master's over there is four or five years scholarship to do Chinese law, essentially. And that was what I would have eventually done, like a master's out there. But I wanted to do English law before I thought about doing Chinese law out there. It was a scholarship for a master's program. I don't know if I specified whether it was going to be law or history, but regardless, I was thinking in my head it was going to be law if I was going to do it out there, but it would have been in Mandarin. I don't think my Mandarin was up to that scratch anyway at the time. But I wanted to do, before I thought about trying something like that, I wanted to come back and do law in English. Before I even thought about trying to do that. I think for me, it was better for me to come back and do that rather than stay out there and finish and use that scholarship that I was kindly given.
What's your Mandarin like these days?
Enough to get by. Like I was going to say ma ma hu, which is so. I mean, I can't have deep philosophical conversations or anything like that. But I do have enough to get by. Like if you threw me out there, I could get by.
Love that. So if that was a difficult time since moving back, has there been any other times that stick out just in the context of this pod being, I suppose, slightly mental health related, that kind of stick out as notable moments in your life or challenges that you kind of needed to deal with on top of that?
Yeah. I think when I went to and did my senior status law degree, that was a challenge. I think for me, because of the nature of the programme, it was a 2-year law degree, essentially, 3 years and two. And you were doing classes with undergraduates, like 18-year-old undergraduates. I'd already done my degree, been to China, coming in at like 21, 22, and there were a lot of like 18-year-olds. So I think I struggled there just because I was like so much older.
In what way did you almost feel
socially,
really? So you can, was it kind of like a, you
I didn't felt like feel I was like going you, back to school in yeah. a way. Do you know,
was
like
there almost a sense of embarrassment there that you did feel older, or was it more that you just didn't feel like you could connect to the younger?
Yeah, I found it quite difficult, I think, to connect, because I think in those years of your lives, there's so much is going on, there's so much development. I mean, between the age of like 18, 21, 22, when you're at university, you're changing so much as an individual. I think that was a challenge. And I didn't, when I went, there were different like colleges and stuff to set up for the degree. And maybe a mature college might have been better because people would have been a bit older my age. But I think that was a real challenge. And I mean, yeah, I think that was quite tricky compared to the experiences I had before. Like in America, it was a lot more enjoyable. It was a lot more social and just so I think that was tricky.
It's a similar principle to, I suppose, what you might have struggled with at the beginning in China, that kind of lack of social.
Yeah, connection. In a different way, really.
How did it like manifest itself? Was it just a sense of loneliness, lack of belonging, or was it not even that deep? Like, how did you feel about the whole thing?
I found it was quite challenging. It was very different, I think, but based off of the academic nature of it as well, it meant, I suppose, the focus was more on academics than it was all quite, I think, serious in that regard. And then that had an effect on people's approach to socialising.
Was it more individualistic? Because it's, academic is quite, it's academia, you kind of tend to be out for yourself. Yes, there's the group work. But because you tend to be thinking about your degree, your marks, your projects, did that almost drive that individualistic lack of social, lack of community element?
Yeah, it's very difficult to put into words, I think.
Mm. Where was this, by the way? This was at
Cambridge.
This was at Cambridge, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the collegiate system as well. It's very different to, I suppose, like a university doesn't have the college system. There's just a number. Yeah, I think the general serious nature. I think that did have an effect on people. I'm not saying that they weren't sociable people. It's just the fact that their mind was elsewhere. It's not that they're horrible people. It's just that their mind was elsewhere, and I think that meant that perhaps they didn't engage as much. And it's not like they were having a good time. They were just focusing on to get their work. I think it was a combination of things, really.
And because that's the culture, you almost can't be seen to be having a laugh, socialising, because that's not the dumb thing. So almost that culture, that individualistic culture, wants for a better word, begets that individualistic culture, and it's a bit of a, I don't want to say vicious cycle, because...
And certainly, I think, and certain subjects as well, more so. And I think it was a challenge for a lot of people there who went. I think especially the two-year course as well, because you've got to think about there's like a number of elements there. The fact I was a bit older, I was doing this course, which is in 2 years rather than three. There were a number of factors at play as well, that I wasn't just your average 18-year-old undergraduate was coming there. So I think there were some factors at play there. And strategically, I think maybe a mature college might have been better for that social element, having people who are similar age to me, similar life experiences, you know. So I think that was...
So you weren't the weird mature student.
No, yeah, exactly. But I think it is. It's difficult. I think take for example America. People do law school out there later, and it's a thing where when you're doing law school out there, you're like usually 20, 22 plus, 23 plus, or even older kind of thing. So there is that kind of more cultural thing to do it when you're older. And It was a strange degree because it was kind of in the middle. It wasn't quite an undergraduate. It wasn't quite a postgraduate. It was in this grey area, which just made it a bit, positionally a bit peculiar in its positioning.
One final thing we need to touch on. Adventure catting. Talk to me. You're a fully fledged influencer.
Oh no, not me. My cat.
Who will be linked in the show notes, because I can do that now. I did that for the first time in the last podcast. I know what I'm doing with that now. I'm going to link Adventure Catting, the Instagram profile. One of the most beautiful cats in the world.
Oh wow, thank you.
Yeah,
I'll tell him you said that. I'm sure he'll be very happy. He'll go to his head. I can't take credit for that. That's my partner, Sophia. She does most of the work there, all of the work actually. I'm in it now and again, some of the clips, but she is the brains and the operations behind that.
Basically, your beautiful cat has its own Instagram page, and one of the posts went viral. Did not get, was it a couple of million views or something?
I think it was 11. Yeah,
11 million views. Yeah. Amazing. It's almost challenging this.
I know. got quite lucky. Yeah, hit the right spot.
How's that? What's he up to this weekend?
He's relaxing. Taking it easy. We took him out the day before yesterday. Thursday evening. He goes out a lot. We take him out for walks. He's very active. Hence the name, Adventure Catting.
Talking of relaxing and take it easy, why don't we wrap this up and go and do exactly that?
Excellent. Sounds good.
Michael Walsh.
Lovely to chat to you, Harry.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Catch you soon. Bye-bye.